Hello and welcome once again to another edition of the KKFI Arts Magazine Show. I am Michael Hoog, your host. Glad to have you with us today on the Arts Magazine Show right here on KKFI 90.1 FM, your community radio station, right here in Kansas City. It is a holiday, Memorial Day Monday. Not much is going on in this building. Is that an invitation for ne'er-do-wellers to go down here? But not much is going on in the building. There is, of course, security downstairs at the bank. Guns loaded. They're having fun down there, actually. Gunplay is going on there. No, not really. As we have fun here on this Memorial Day, which is a day of reverence, of course. I don't want to mention that. It's a day when we sit back and we remember those who have sacrificed so much that we should enjoy the freedoms that we have today. So remember that as we go through Memorial Day today, as before you drink your beer or go to your barbecue or whatever all else you have planned. We're going to talk about shows on the theater on the show today. We have a very interesting show, a very good show is about to open over at the Barn Players of Johnson County. It's called August Osage County. Some of you may have seen it previously at the Kansas City Repertory Theater, where they did a great job over there. It was also a major motion picture with Julia Roberts a few months ago. But the Barn Players are doing it now. I'm sure they have their own twist on it. And with me on this holiday, two people I enjoy interviewing the most are here with us to tell us all about it. John Rensenhouse is here. He's making an appearance at the Barn Players. I bet it's been years. I've been told that in years past, way back when, you actually appeared at the Barn Players when you were...
Theatrical start at the Barn Players in 1975.
Wow.
Playing Starbuck in The Rainmaker when I was, I think, 19 years old.
Wow.
Indeed.
Well, you'd be
good in that role. I just outed myself for age. Oh, dear. Don't do the math, people. Don't do the math.
It's too late for the 7-second delay, so I can't help you. Goodbye. But, you know, that would be a good role for you, I would think. Are you a good salesman type?
Can
you
Oh, sure. Yeah, no, that was a very fun role. So then... What is that now, 40 years later? I return to the barn. I return to the barn.
You get yourself in more trouble now.
I'm very excited to be back there.
But he started out there. He's come full circle, but he still is very much in professional theater, as you know. John Rensenhouse has been a leading actor and director in Kansas City for quite some years now. That's the way I'm going to put it.
Has
toured nationally with two Broadway productions, Noises Off and The Lion King. Lion King was not that... not that long ago, appears most frequently these days at the Heart of America Shakespeare Festival, where I take it you'll be appearing again in another
month or
so.
Yeah, we're set to begin rehearsals for The Winter's Tale, coming this summer, The Winter's Tale, out in the park, which will open mid-June and play to early July.
Yeah, I think of John Rensenhouse now as a Shakespearean actor, because I've seen him
do many other things,
but I think of him as a Shakespearean actor. I've seen him do so many roles, even Caesar. You actually went blonde for Caesar.
I did. That was very fun. I'm going gray for this one.
Yeah, it's interesting. I met John for the first time when we did the interview for Caesar. But I had seen John many times on stage before that. It was interesting to meet you.
I've
seen you perform so many times. He has extensive credits other than that. You know, has done Shakespeare at prestigious regional theaters around the country. Performed a lot at the Kansas City Repertory Theater. A lot at the Kansas City with the Kansas City Actors Theater. Is also the managing director of the Kansas City Actors Theater as well. Notable performances, Atticus Finch, To Kill a Mockingbird.
Yes, and Dracula. Do not forget Dracula.
and Antony and Cleopatra. And his favorite is Dracula.
Oh, yes, that's the best part ever, because everybody talks about you and it's a great build-up, and then you just swoop in and get to bite people on the neck.
He's also done television. Was one of the regulars for a while on The Edge of Night. A bad guy, as he told me. He was a bad guy. But it's nice to have you with us once again today.
Great to be here.
Barb Nichols is with us as well. She's an actress in this show, and she has acting credits, and somehow they got transposed on my notes. Some of her directing credits are actually acting credits, but has directed Company and Les Mis over at the White Theater.
Correct.
At Johnson
County. Most recently, yes.
Are you Are you going to be directing there in the near future?
Yeah, I'll be doing a show next January, The Tale of the Allergist's Wife,
yeah.
At the Jewish Community Center.
Yeah, I don't know how the tragedy over there affected them that much, but
well,
that's
I
a
think
sad
they've
thing.
Shown a lot of resilience. And
I was recently in Israel, you know, within the last month I was in Israel. And believe it or not, our tour guide knew about that incident. Apparently they keep very close track of anti-Semitic acts all over the world. And he asked me about the White Theater in Kansas when he saw I was from the Kansas
wow.
City area. So they keep track of those things, and they knew of that incident, even as far away as Israel. But anyway, Barb has directed company, Les Mis, at the White Theater, has directed at the Barn Players, the Leawood Stage Company, the Chestnut, Theater in the Park, has performed a few times as well. Just give me some of your performing credits.
I have to go way back. I think the last time was at the Chestnut.
As far back as John.
Not quite.
Okay.
At the Chestnut, I think it was the last time I performed in Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat.
Yeah.
And then the year before that, I performed in Godspell there. And then we kind of have to go back to college days, so we're really going back. And I'm not going to say any years. I don't think there's need to tax anybody's math for that.
But now, as a director, are you finding it educational to be back in the acting side of things?
Yes.
Are you learning things?
I'm really enjoying it. And the other night I was like, oh, so this is what tech is like on the other side. It's been a great learning experience to work with Darren Sextro. And everybody's got a different approach, and I really appreciate how he works with the actors, and it's been wonderful.
Did you seek out this part? Did go auditions with the idea of playing a particular role?
Yes, I had thought about applying to direct it, and then that didn't work out, and Darren mentioned that maybe I should come and audition, and that had been in the back of my mind, and so I did, and it worked out.
Well, tell me about the character. If people haven't seen the movie, if they haven't seen another stage version of the This is a real woman show for the most part. Some men are in it. John, for instance. I assume you're the husband, the main father.
Yeah, I play Beverly Weston, who is the patriarch of this family, the father. And I open the show in what is called the prologue. You see Beverly interviewing a Indian American who he wants to hire to help around the house. And I will say no more about my character.
Say no more.
You surely shouldn't. But you're one of the daughters.
Right.
And this is really a woman's show for the most part. It's the conflict between the women really drive the story.
It does. The mother and the three daughters. And then there's some husbands and relatives.
They only have they have parts, but they really the story isn't driven by anything they do, really.
Right. So I play the oldest daughter, Barbara. And which is very
easy,
good.
Easy for you to remember.
I know when to answer when people call me. As I say, they kind of put the fun in dysfunctional.
Yeah.
This family. Yeah. They have a lot of issues and secrets. But I'm always amazed as we go through the rehearsal process how many of the actors would say, oh, you know, this reminds me of my family. Or this. There was a situation where this came up and this reminds me of an aunt or... And so while I'd say it's a little heightened for the show, there's so many things that are familiar, I think, for anybody who comes to see it as far as their family and family dynamics go, which makes it kind of fun.
The conflict between the young ladies and mother and,
like you said,
the secrets involved.
Yes.
There's some A lot of family secrets
that unfold as the show progresses.
I love this play. I remember when I first saw it on Broadway. You know, it played on Broadway, I think, in like 2007 to 2009. And just thinking, this is the greatest play I've ever seen.
Yeah.
It's the best play of this century, Michael.
It was one of the better plays I've seen at the Rep, and that's not discounting the Rep at all, but that was one of their better efforts.
Right. Yeah. Well, it's such a great play. So.
And it really sucks you in. When we saw it at the Rep, we took some friends with us, and they go to theater occasionally. And the husband said, "Now, what's this about?" And I said, "Well, it's about a dysfunctional family in Oklahoma, and it's got about a 3-hour running time." He was like, "Oh my gosh." And when the show was over, they were just raving, and they're like, "Well, we really want Act 4. We want to see what happens. We want to spend more time with these people." It just sucks you in, and it's funny, and it's dark, and it's just entrancing, I think.
Yeah, well, I can see where he'd want an Act 4, but But boy, those characters have been put through so much as it is.
Yeah.
It would really grieve them considerably to be put through even more. But it is that kind of a story, I mm-hmm. think, all the things that happen and the potential for other things that could have happened along the way as well. Don't you think that kind of... that leaves the audience kind of with a wide open mind as to where this could go at any certain part of the story as well.
Yes, indeed. And I'm very proud of the Barn for taking on such a big, sweeping, difficult project such as this.
Yes.
And it's so difficult, in fact, the director, Darren Sextro, whose name we've mentioned, he's the director. And it's so difficult and so stressful on the director that Darren is having to have a massage today while we're doing this interview. Darren is getting a massage. So
we're sending him soothing thoughts.
Yes, we're saying, I hope that's going well for you, Darren.
And they're playing some nice music in the background as you're getting your massage.
He better be listening.
Yeah.
Yes. We're speaking with actors John Rensenhouse and Barb Nichols, and they're both directors as well. Not in this particular production. They've both been directors. And we're talking about the Barn Players production of August Osage County, which opens, boy, it's coming up soon, Friday, May the 30th, 7:30 p.m.
Yes.
For a nice three-weekend run at the Barn Players of Johnson County. The Barn, by the way, is located at 6219 Martway in Mission, Kansas, and the number to call for information is 800-838-3006. And if you'd like to MapQuest things, you need, as well as the address, you need the zip code as well, and that is 66202. We're speaking with John Rensenhouse and Barb Nichols. They've both been directors. They're actors in this show. Tell us about the rest of the cast of the show.
Indeed, it's an all-star cast.
It
it's
is.
A really great cast.
It is a great cast. It's a big cast. People who there's some people making their Barn debut. I think Tim Elanius, and going to try to get this right. Tim Elanius, I don't think, has performed at the Barn before, and Elizabeth Hillman and Courtney Desko. I don't know about Michael Bunn. He's in the show. All wonderful, and they may be making their Barn debut. And then there's some people that have performed at the Barn in the past that people will recognize. Greg Butel, Stasha Case, Jennifer Coville, Trevor French, Pam Haskin, Eric Magnus, Anita Meehan.
Oh, yeah.
So it's a big cast, very talented group of people.
Stasha is always very good.
Stasha's great. She's another sister.
She's the youngest sister, Karen.
Karen. She's the youngest sister, and she's wonderful.
Maybe we should nail this down. There's a mother and how many sisters?
Three. Mm-hmm. Three daughters, played by myself, Elizabeth Hillman, and Stasha Case.
And Anita Meehan is the mother, Violet, my wife.
Yeah.
It's my wife, Violet. She takes pills and I drink.
Well, that's a good start.
And that pretty much sums up the show.
What is the major source of conflict between the sisters and their mother? Or the sisters between each other?
Between the daughters and the mother, I would say the pill-taking, mm-hmm. the addiction issue. And the bitterness and meanness that pervades her. I think she's just an angry person. And between the sisters, I think it's probably an age old of who's going to take care of the parents and who's going to bear that responsibility and who's not going to do that. And I think that becomes an issue amongst them. And that leads to some conflict.
Yeah, it took me a while before I kind of figured out that the motives of the mother in the show.
Yes.
That's a source of conflict for the young ladies as well?
I think it's more who's going to deal with her or mom or dad and who has to. And one of the sisters has been doing it and she's not caring to do it anymore. And so who's going to step up and do it? And nobody wants to, basically. And, there's a nice little foreword in the script that talks about parents, not wanting to let their children go and always trying to get them back. And I think that's probably the parents' motivation.
Yeah, I kind of felt she controlled them in her own way. Not a conventional way, but control them in her own
very manipulative
way.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a lot about, the script we can't talk about without giving things away. But there is the thing is kind of set around a gathering. Let's say that.
Yes, an event occurs and the family comes home, and then you go. You kind of the issues arise from there.
And young ladies, I should say, that have husbands. The husbands come as well, and they have to play a part in this
yes.
as well.
Yes, yeah. And they have their own set of issues. Yeah. The husbands and the significant others.
Everyone has
Everybody's
issues.
Got issues.
Osage County, well, is in Oklahoma, as John said earlier.
Yes, we somebody renamed this production June Johnson County.
Really? That's the way it happens, yeah. I suppose.
But Osage County is yeah, it's outside of Tulsa.
Uh-huh. Kind of a rural area of Oklahoma?
Yeah, they have access. My character is a teacher at the University of Tulsa.
Oh.
So they're close enough to...
And one of the daughters is a... I guess works at the library at
yes,
the university.
Yeah, so close to Tulsa, but still, you know, hard scrabble land.
I probably haven't studied the play like all of you have. The lady that wrote the play, now, is there a special reason she wrote the play? Was it based on any specific...
It's actually a man.
It's a man.
His name is Tracy Letts. It won the Pulitzer Prize in 2008, which is, as you mentioned, you know, it's really a woman's... driven show,
it is, yeah.
And yet a man wrote it so beautifully. You probably could speak more to this. I think he's from Oklahoma.
Yeah, he is from Oklahoma. And actually, the part I'm playing, the part of the father, was originated by his father.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he wrote the part for his father. So I'm sure there's a lot of autobiographical mm-hmm. stuff in there.
I don't know what that says for his family.
Yeah.
But he's a great playwright, you know, out of... Chicago, Steppenwolf. He works with Steppenwolf. This was first done at the Steppenwolf Theater in Chicago. He wrote Killer Joe, Bug, Superior Donuts was his more recent one that he wrote after this. This one won 5 Tony Awards for Best Play, and he's a great guy at the theater. He's an actor. He himself won a Tony Award for the recent revival of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, where he and Amy Morton played the two main characters, and he won a Tony Award for his portrayal there.
Yeah, I guess he's into realism then.
Yeah, I guess
at least
so.
In this.
Yeah. Well, and this play has a lot in common, I think, with Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf in terms of
The dark humor and the
there is a lot of dark humor. Is that easy for all of you to tread? The dark humor.
Oh, easy and fun.
John says fun. What about Barbara?
Oh,
the ladies?
Definitely. The joke was, my character cusses like a sailor.
Uh-huh.
And as my oldest son said, that's going to be worth the price of admission.
I think
a lot of the humor sometimes comes from the language and the things that are said. And so after a few weeks, it just starts flowing. You don't think too much about it, but I think the humor is really important to the show. It's funnier probably than people realize it's going to be.
Yeah, isn't it interesting how something like that can also be so chock full of humor
mm-hmm.
along the way as well?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really is. The show opens very soon, this Friday, May 30th. Everyone ready for this? Emotionally as well as physically?
I think so. I mean, you rehearse so long, and then you're really ready. You know, God love the crew and the directors and all them. They laugh as much as they can, and there reaches a point where you're like, I've heard this plenty of times, and I do think it's funny, but you want that audience response. You want to hear what the audience thinks is funny and what the audience thinks is surprising. So we're all ready. We've got Tech Week, but we'll be ready for Friday.
I know performers like to play around with the part. Now, has any of the animosity between the ladies spilled over into the... I would think there would be a lot of fodder for humor along the way.
Oh, everybody is...
How's that backstage drama going?
So far, so good. I think you really get close to one another with something like this, because you're so dependent on each other. And it is pretty dramatic, and there's physicality, there's fighting and slapping, and so you have to have a pretty good bond off stage so that you feel safe and confident on stage. And I mean, this is a wonderful cast. Everybody's supportive and hardworking, and that translates, I think, to the stage.
I guess finding the proper mix would be good.
Yes. Now, speaking of backstage, we should mention that those who are used to coming to the barn, when they come this time, they're going to see a completely different kind of theater. They've torn out part of the stage. This play is written to be performed in a 3-story home. If you remember the set at the Rep, it was quite enormous and everything. And the ceiling at the barn doesn't really allow for that, so the set designer, Frank I don't know Frank's last
Frank
name.
Frank Pollock.
Frank Pollock.
Fabulous.
Fabulous.
Talented.
Has done a brilliant, genius job of creating a three-story house inside the Barn Theater there, which is no small feat, uh-huh. Let me tell you.
It looks amazing.
Yeah,
I've never seen anything like that at the Barn. People will be, I think, if they're season ticket holders or they've gone to several shows, they'll be surprised.
Yeah. It's really an amazing set.
Having the proper set, the proper costuming.
And a shout-out to the props, Rhonda.
Oh, Rhonda. This is very heavy. They eat a lot and a lot of
dinner scenes.
Yeah.
I mean, she's just been fabulous. We need something. She's got it. Everything looks so realistic. And
Dad's books, lots of books.
Yeah, I've been so impressed. You know, I'm come from the, you know, the professional theater, and this is, this might as well be semi-professional, but for a community theater, it is really, they've got their stuff together there. It's well-organized, well-run, and the set is great, and the lighting and props and sound and all that are very great.
They do a great job at the Barn. They're very well-organized
really
over there.
They do.
They have good directors, so good board people.
Yeah. Well, you know, I got to say, I mean, the whole community theater scene, if you can call it that here in Kansas City, is very strong. I mean, the White Theater, where Barb directs, and, you know, Theater in the Park, and Leawood Stage, and all those places seem to have.
Barb's directed at all those places.
Many of them, I concur. I mean, they are all, you know, they're strong, they're well managed, they support good arts in the community. It's just a wonderful gift for us.
This is a whole other discussion. I probably shouldn't get into it with a limited amount of time we have here.
Well,
you both direct as well as act. There's a different technique there. What do you have a preference? Would you rather direct a play?
As I get older, I think I prefer being a director because the memorization of the lines is getting to be more and more a chore, and just sort of the fear of, you know, maybe forgetting.
And you have Shakespeare coming up. That has to be some of the hardest memorization there is.
Well, Shakespeare actually is surprising. Once you get it in your head, the poetry of it helps it stick there better. Doing a lot of Shakespeare, I don't get to do modern naturalistic stuff like this is very much. So I'm enjoying that, but I'm finding some of the lines are, if you forget, where was I? It's harder to get back on track.
You were very good in that World War I drama of a few months ago that you actually performed, by the way, at the Liberty Memorial Theater.
Yes, uh-huh.
Actors Theater and UMKC collaborated on that.
That's correct. Well, thank you, Michael. But, yeah. But I do prefer the directing a little bit now. I don't know. How about you, Barb?
What about Barb?
As I said, I hadn't performed in many, many years, and those roles were ensemble in a musical. So I'm really enjoying acting because I haven't done it in so long. And as any director will tell you, there's just so much more to think about when you're the director versus the actor. The first night at the rehearsal, when I walked out the door, I was like, wait, I don't have to lock the door or wait for anybody else to leave. It's like, this is nice. Because I haven't done it in so long, I'm really appreciating it. I like both. I love directing, you know, getting to kind of get your vision up there on stage, but I'm having a ball doing this too.
Yeah, and I agree with that term you use. Your vision on stage.
Yes.
That's really what it is.
But that was probably my most nerve-wracking thing was the memorization. There's a lot of words in this play, and but we're getting there.
Yeah, if you can't learn lines, it's hard to be an actor. Well, who knows though? With the advent of Google Glasses and all that, maybe the words will be put in front of you.
Hey, good idea.
The words will be right in the corner. Where I work at KU, they actually have a set of Google Glasses, and you can see it's right in the corner of your right eye. They actually put the picture of what you're reading.
Oh, perfect! Yes, I think this character wears glasses.
Yeah. Mine too. We all inherited that bad eyes from Dad.
Right.
August Osage County, directed by Jaron Sextro, opens on Friday, May 30th. Performances continue the 31st. And June 1st, the evening performances at 7:30. The afternoon matinees, usually, I think almost always on Sunday, is at 2 o'clock p.m. Then the next weekend, 6, 7, and 8, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Monday, May 9th performance, industry night, 7:30 on Monday night the 9th. Then Friday the 13th, the 13th, Saturday the 14th, evening performances, and it wraps up with a Sunday afternoon matinee on Sunday the 15th at the Barn Players of Johnson County, online at thebarnplayers.org. You have to get the in there. And as I always say, there are other organizations, believe it or not, in this country named Barn Players.
Yes, there are.
So you have to put thebarnplayers.org in there. And the number to call for more information is 800-838-3006, 800-838-3006. There is a number for other problems other than ticketing, for instance, a handicap situation, that if you have questions, 913-432-9100. The barn is located at 6219 Martway in Mission, Kansas. If you MapQuest things, the zip code is 66202. I want to thank my guests for being with us and telling us about another fine play. The Barn Players do so many fine plays and have in recent years. August Osage County, it opens May 30th on a Friday at the Barn Players in Mission, Kansas. I want to thank our guests for being with us. John Rensenhaus, leading actor and director in Kansas City. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me here, Michael.
And Barb Nichols, a director as of late, now hitting the boards again as an actress. Who knows? We'll be seeing you more on stage as well as in front of the stage.
We'll see what everybody thinks. We'll go from there. But thank you very much.
You're welcome. And best to all of your endeavors coming up in the future. We're going to take our break. When we come back, it's Memorial Day. Who knows what we're going to do? It's kind of a potpourri on this holiday Monday. When we return, you're listening to the Arts Magazine radio program right here on KKFI, 90.1 FM.
Freeze Frame!
Hi, I'm Russ Simmons with Freeze Frame, KKFI's weekly look at the newest cinematic fare at your local theaters. Marvel Comic Addicts, it's been nearly a month since your last cinematic fix, so you'll be glad to know that X-Men Days of Future Past is finally here. And it's worth the wait. Two time periods are crossed as we see the young and old versions of Professor X and Magneto join forces in a time-bending effort to save the future. Well-acted, intense, stylish, and shot through with welcome humor, X-Men Days of Future Past is just what summer blockbusters are supposed to be. Adam Sandler and Drew Barrymore are paired for the fourth time in Blended, a broad, goofy, and obvious family comedy. Sandler plays a widower with three kids who goes on an African vacation with a single mom, Barrymore, and her two kids. Could they ever find romance? What do you think? Much of the humor is insipid, and the efforts to tug on our heartstrings are awkward at best. But Barrymore is always likable, and Terry Crews has some funny moments as a resort entertainer. At best, it's harmless. Chef is a delightful comedy written and directed by its star, Jon Favreau. He plays a culinary artist who loses his restaurant job and goes on a road trip with his young son in a food truck. It has some material that earns it an R rating, which is too bad because otherwise it'd be perfect for families. Eat first or else you'll be salivating at all the luscious food on display in Chef. Hornet's Nest is a harrowing documentary about two embedded journalists who get in over their heads when accompanying some American soldiers in Afghanistan. Ambushed by enemy forces, their one-day journey turned into a nine-day nightmare, and the footage they captured gives audiences a real sense of the horrors of war. Also opening this week, The Immigrant is a 1920s period romantic drama starring Joaquin Phoenix and Marianne Cotillard. Well, that's it for this edition of Freeze Frame. Until next time, I'm Russ Simmons with Fox 4 and KKFI-FM.
Freeze Frame!
On the next Alternative Radio.
Traders, or really the leaders of these banks, have been rewarded for their mistakes. And they've not been held accountable for their institutional risk. And the fines that they've paid, or the Department of Justice has made them pay, or the SEC has made them pay, have been nothing compared to the risk they take and the assets they have, and the assets they've been allowed to amass since the last crisis and after each crisis.
Former investment banker Nomi Prince, Wednesday morning at 9.
Did you know that our national debt is actually our nation's savings? Professor L. Randall Ray will discuss how modern money theory tends to favor a positive role for fiscal policy in the economy. Join us Wednesday at noon for another All Souls Forum right here on KKFI.
Wednesday night is Arts Night on KKFI. At 6 p.m., it's Art Speak Radio, followed by the award-winning From Art to Microchip at 6:30. Then it's live radio theater on L.A. Theater Works from 7 to 9 p.m., followed by chamber music with Dr. Mike. Get your arts on Wednesday night on KKFI.
Hi, this is Judy Ansel. On Saturday, June 14th at IBEW Local 124, the Heartland Labor Forum will celebrate 25 years of talking back to the boss with two of our favorite hellraisers, America's number one populist Jim Hightower and labor troubadour Ann Feeney. We'll have a VIP meet and greet dinner at 6 p.m., followed by a hell-raising speech and concert at 7. Details, advance tickets, and directions are available at kkfi.org. We do the
work. And welcome back to the Arts Magazine Show right here on KKFI 90.1 FM, your community radio station right here in Kansas City. I'm Michael Hoag, your host. It's Memorial Day. Things kind of slow down around here on Memorial Day. Very few of us are in the building right now. The Insider is here preparing his jazz show at 1 o'clock. Great jazz played by the Insider. I'm always fascinated by the inside information about the various recording sessions that he'll talk about, the history of the musicians, all of that. And then at 3, jazz and blues as well. That's what KKFI is known for around here. It's jazz and it's blues and the various establishments around town. It's a great partnership with Kansas City and the various music organizations and this radio station. And why do I say all this? Because next week is another fundraising week for KKFI. The summer fund drive will be coming up beginning later this week, actually, and spilling into the next week. And you will have a chance to call in and give your donation to help support community radio here in Kansas City, KKFI. And that starts later this week. Of course, I think on Friday you'll have a chance to do that. And we'll all be a part of a fun drive and the various things that keeps KKFI alive and vibrant and all the things that go along with that. Speaking of music, whenever there's some celebrities in town, they generally get brought around to the various radio stations and to this radio station as well, or we're given an opportunity to talk to them and learn a little bit about them personally, as well as their music and what's going on. And that's the great thing about being on a radio station. You get to meet these people. You get to have a word with them and all that goes into that. I thought I'd share with you today, because it's Memorial Day and most people are out going to their barbecues, their picnics, their other activities, shall we say, they have going on this day. I thought I'd journey into a few years ago when I had a chance to speak with one of the obscure, not so obscure now, of course, but at the time, we're all familiar with Motown. Motown actually began in Detroit. I guess the headquarters are in Los Angeles now. But Motown Records began in Detroit, in actually a neighborhood. Yes, the famous Motown Records was in a neighborhood. One of the recording studios was actually in a house that they revamped. The offices were in another house in a neighborhood in Motown. It's kind of hard to picture. You can tour that now, and you can go visit those various places. But I had a chance to meet with some of the musicians. Now, we think of the Motown artists, you know, Smokey Robinson, I could name a bunch of them, of course, but they all basically had the same studio musicians that worked for them. The studio musicians were called the Funk Brothers, and they played for all the Motown artists. And as you'll hear in the course of this discussion, they played for all of the Motown artists. They had to adapt to the different styles of a lot of the Motown artists. And this all ended, really, when Motown Records moved, when Barry Cordy moved most of Motown Records to the Los Angeles area. So these guys were out of work for a while. Well, an ambitious filmmaker wanted to feature some of these musicians because they were great. You could hear them. When you listen to a Motown song from the 60s and 70s, these are the guys that were playing in the background, and they had a certain style to it, as you'll hear them talk about in the course of the interview about the way they played. They adapted to certain musicians, but basically there was a certain style to it, and these guys all adapted to the style. But an independent filmmaker a few years back made a documentary about their work. It was called Sitting in the Shadow of Motown, because no one really knew who they were. But through the course of this documentary, the ones that were still living, you got to know them in the documentary. And they traveled around with the documentary movie, and when it had its playing here in town, I actually got to sit down and had a conversation with them at one of the Plaza hotels, and there was eating and drinking going on at the time. You can hear glasses clinking in the background, but I had my tape recorder rolling because I wanted to hear all of this. But you get a sense of what it was like to be there, to do that job, to work with those people, yet to be unknown by the public at large. And this documentary went a long ways to fixing that problem for them. So here's my interview with the Funk Brothers, as they called them as a group. And the name of the documentary was Sitting in the Shadow of Motown. Here is some of that conversation I had with the Funk Brothers.
Well, I was really impressed with the camaraderie I noticed in the movie. There was one particular section where several of you were talking, and there had been a riot had gone on. And one of you mentioned that you'd even be willing to take a bullet for your buddies.
And there he is. I don't think I would have.
Was that a frightening experience?
Well, yeah, it was frightening, yeah. To say it wasn't a riot, look, I saw white folks and black folks skilling together.
Yeah.
And it's supposed to have been a riot where you're supposed to be hitting and fighting one another. They were skilling together. Breaking in stores, stealing together, right, Bob?
Yeah, he's right.
Yeah, he's telling you the truth.
Not only had they played together in decades, but some of them hadn't played their instrument in decades. Joe Messina, for instance, from Motown Movement 72, he stopped playing guitar and took up the chromatic harmonica. So he, a month before the movie started, he picked up, pulled his guitar out from under his bed and started getting his chops together again. Eddie Willis hadn't played in 10 years, the other guitar player. Because he was on the road for 20 years with the Four Tops after Motown left Detroit. And when he stopped touring with the Tops, he stopped playing for 10 years. So he had to relearn his instrument. Now, the other guys were all playing during that time. And one of the reasons why it was able to happen was that Motown was always very easy for these guys to play, for the simple reason that in most R&B house bands, the musicians, their background was R&B, maybe a little bit of rock and roll, blues. These guys had all that, but they also were extremely accomplished jazz musicians, which takes a much higher level of dexterity and harmonic knowledge. So when they came to play Motown, it's like a weightlifter who can lift 500 pounds, but he's only called upon to lift 200 pounds. So it was easy, and the reason that Motown had the sound that it did was because it was so effortless and it swung so hard. Like Booker T and the MGs were one of the great house bands of the 60s, but they didn't have a jazz background. And their music is funk, it rocks, but it doesn't swing. And swing, you've got to be a jazz musician. A lot of the Motown songs are these, kind of shuffle, like How Sweet It Is. We hear Jameson going boom, 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 boom. It's got a deep swing to it, and it's because they were jazz musicians. So when you have this long layoff, If they were called upon after a long layoff to play jazz, this wouldn't happen. Mm-hmm. But they were called upon to play something that was extremely easy for them. So even with the long layoff, when they came back to it, it was tough this time around because they didn't have the chops. Yeah, they didn't have the chops that they did, and there were a lot of health issues. But that's the reason it was able to happen. Ural, for instance, and the other drummer who unfortunately passed away, Pistol Allen, passed since the film. Neither of these guys had any business playing this movie. They didn't tell me how sick they were. Ural made a quintuple bypass, and he had it a few days after we wrapped the shooting, and Pistol was dying of lung cancer. They had no business. They were risking their lives doing it. And
you never know in that time.
And because it was so important, because they knew their whole life, this was their whole life right here. This was their chance to say to the world, this is what I did. And they'd never get that chance again, so they weren't going to miss it. So they risked their lives to do this movie. And, thank God for one and unfortunate for the other, I guess, because Pistol's not here. But I think, Pistol, if he had a choice, he would have rather had himself go out that way with his legacy preserved than to miss the opportunity.
But it went so hard that, like you say, how the Suski and Matthew get that together. That was the easy part. His job was convincing us that we could do this, because the first day I rehearsal, you're talking about some strange feelings. I was scared to death. I said, I done told Celestia, that I could do this stuff. And then when it comes to the point, I said, man, how can imagine what we're going to sound like? it was scary, you know. And then all of us coming together at the same time, and I know he hadn't played in so many years, this guy hadn't played in so many years. I said, boy, we're going to sound a mess down here. You know, but after a few days, it just came in, and that's everything jelly came back to everybody.
Yeah, for me, it was a real relief because, you know, I went in at our first day not knowing if they could still play.
Yeah, so I knew something was scared.
I had 14 years in the project at that point, you know, because I had 3 years writing a book and 11 years searching for funding. So I was like, did I just throw out 14 years of my life? I didn't know. And then within 5 minutes, we were playing Heat Wave on the first song. It was rocking. So I said, oh, thank God, you know. This whole thing has been a situation of being able to exhale because we lost two guys along the way. We lost Oliver Van Dyke and Robert White, who died before I could get funded. And, you know, I was fighting a biological time clock because, you know, their age, and I didn't want to lose anymore. And, you know, when we finally wrapped it, I knew, you know, okay, the legacy's preserved now, you know. So I could let out a
not breath. Saying that we're old.
You know, it's funny. What do you tell me when Earl's wife said, when you were just saying,
about you?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, Earl's wife said, I said, this guy Slusky, he's putting all this money into me. He says, one thing I can say. He got to be either that. He got to be a crazy white man or a rich white man.
Yeah, I knew he wasn't crazy because
he wasn't rich.
He called me. And he said, "I'm in Livonia, and I got a retainer for you." And it sort of shocked me. And I looked. I said, "Yeah, let me go out there and see him." Yeah. I knew he wasn't crazy. He had a retainer in hand.
Yeah. Joe made a 30-minute trip in about 10 minutes.
How long did it take for me to make it?
10 or 15.
Before, yeah, it was like, you know, I don't think Muhammad Ali, he says, I could turn off the light and be in bed before it gets dark.
It was like
before your voice faded on the phone, you were next to me in the house, and it was 20 miles away.
And then I knew Heat Wave, because I played on Heat Wave, but I was steadily looking at that check, and I figured out that no problem. Put the music up there, and I said,
yes, it is. The main thing, though, is not so much being a headline, but just to put our faces on the records, the tunes that we did now.
Yeah.
You know, names and faces.
Names and faces.
To the tunes that we did.
And I moved out of Detroit and moved to the East Coast, and now I'm in Nashville, but I'm coming in touch with a lot of musicians, and it's really hard when you're hearing stories about certain musicians that claim to have played on those records because of the, you know, there wasn't the credits on the records for a long time. That's the hardest part. And Joe Hunter's got the greatest story about Chicago. Go ahead, Joe. About meeting Joe Hunter.
When I knew the producer of Chess's Records in Chicago, and he called me and said, come over and do a few tunes. I got a few tunes and I want you to touch. And when I got there, he came and got me and smiled and everything. He said, I want to introduce you to somebody. So I went to this guy. He introduced me to him. He said, this is Joe Hunter. And I said, you the Joe Hunter that worked at Motown? He says, yes. I said, you did Pride and Joy with Marvin? Yes. And I named a few other tunes. And he says, oh, you didn't give me your name. I said, well, I'm Joe Hunter, too. And he said, you Joe Hunter Morton. He said, come here, let me talk with you. See, I had to get this job, but I had to use a name. But he could play, he could actually play good. Anyway, he said he had to impress the people over there in order to get the job. So I said, I forgive you for the fraud or whatever, you know, whatever you call it, using somebody else's name. I said, but don't do it no more. I said, you can go by your own name now. You got the job and you're here and they like you, you know. But he was another Joe Hunter. He was me. I met myself.
Tell me the end of it, though. Huh? Told him about you half of the money for the session. The reason we did that, because the movie is about, you know, everybody you talk to, you say, what's the Motown sound? They say everything but the musicians. You know, just like even in the movie, you know, there's a part in that way, you know, where I explain and say, you hear some people may say it's a food or something. I say, I like to see somebody take some pork chops, a hamburger, and throw it down that studio, shut the door, and count four and get a hit, you know. But everybody, so we said this way, whatever artists we want, we'll use no Motown artists. And we still got the Motown sound. See, so that, you know, because like one of the guys in the group said, you could say, we used to take a chicken out off the street or something, wring his neck in the studio, and with the funk brother, you got a hit.
So was it more like the artist had to adapt to you, more than you to the artist?
No, it wasn't that. We had the sound. That we think of the basic Motown sound. We had, the groups had a lot to do with it, but the basic music Motown sound was the musicians. So in order to prove it, we used artists that wasn't associated with Motown, and they sung Motown songs.
And it still sounded like
Motown.
And
it's still the Motown sound. That's just a different word, but it's the Motown sound.
See, the whole thing is that the when you think about it, like, take the Supremes. The Supremes only sang on the Supremes. They didn't sing on the Four Tops. They didn't sing on the Vandellas. They didn't sing with Stevie. Stevie didn't sing with the Tops. Probably the busiest musician, person at Motown was Smokey, because he was a producer, a songwriter, and an artist. So if you take all the tracks he was involved with, maybe it's 40% of the whole company, but whatever, he's still not on the other 60%. Well, these guys were on everything. So the only continuity that ran through the Motown sound was these guys. And, you know, most of the Motown acts, when you take the Motown acts out on the road, Burry, from the very beginning, had a different concept. He was looking for a Vegas. He was looking for this high energy. So, you know, you'll take a song that has, like, a great groove, like Get Ready, you know, do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. Well, when you see the Temptations play that live, you know, all these blaring horns, because he was looking for this big Vegas, you know, high energy, energy, energy. But the Motown sound wasn't about energy. It was about feel-good head-bobbing music. Mm-hmm. And that sound only came from these guys. And no other musicians could get it. And then the first thing that ever happened to me, I'll never forget, when I came out to Detroit one time, and I had never heard any of them play live. And I went to see I went with Pistol to a club, and they called him up on stage. It was funny. It was at the Bomax. And Pistol walked in. Pistol was very flamboyant. There was a guy, what was his name, Robert Thrasher?
Norman Thrasher
was singing. Yeah. And he walks into, you know, I mean, this guy's right in the middle of a sensitive ballad. And Pistol walks into the place and goes, Norman Thrasher, the Pistol's in the house. and Norman just stopped what he was singing, and he brought him up on stage immediately. He said, ladies and gentlemen, the great Motown, John Pistol Allen, right? And he started to play, Heat Wave, which was his, because Pistol was the shuffle guy.
Yeah.
And my reaction was this, you know, because as a musician, I've played Motown songs for 35 years now. I can't tell you how many weddings and bar mitzvahs I played. The obligatory Motown medley of Get Ready, Dancing in the Streets with My Girl and Heat Wave. And they never sound like these guys, right? And the second I heard Pistol, this was the reaction. It was like, oh my God, that's it. You know, and I played these songs a million times with real musicians, and the first time, because it wasn't a sound. It was a sound that was the creation and the sole property of a very small group of gifted musicians. And it's proven by the fact that when they went out to L.A. and didn't use these musicians, they lost the sound.
Yeah, most of the artists is dubbed in. Yeah. You make the band tracks a lot of times first and then dub them in.
Well, you never saw the artists.
Yes, the artists had adapted them. It wasn't them adapting to the artists. In the early days, it was a give and take, because they didn't have enough tracks, everybody cut it live.
Yeah.
But, you know, once they got into, you know, 8 tracks, the artists brought, you know, these guys cut first, and then the artists came in. Sometimes they, you know, songwriters didn't even know what artist it was going to be for. They just made them cut, then figured out, oh, maybe we'll plug this group in, maybe we'll try that group.
Well, that might be easier technically in editing, but I would think you'd lose the give and take between everyone doing it like that.
Okay, say like,
one process.
45 miles, they wouldn't stop. Okay, when that drum solo in there, when we would cut that, when I did the drum solo, when Starr dubbed in, part of that record, he's singing my drum solo with me. Da 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 da, you know, he's singing it along with me. See, if I hadn't did that solo in there, he'd probably put something else in there, but he sung what I was playing.
But that was also the genius of some producers. If they cut something and they had the idea for the song, but the artist wasn't there, and then they'd hear something that happened in the song, they may, for example, on some of the spring students with Jameson's bass line, they gave to the horns to play. Now, they would have never had that horn part
as part of the arrangement.
As part of the arrangement prior to cutting that track. But once the track was cut and they felt that groove, they said, "Oh, let's do this. We'll have the horns do exactly what he's doing." And it just also went like Euro said, to the vocals too, where the vocals served things. And maybe if it wasn't the actual artist, the producer might have said, yeah, do it just like with the drums right there.
See, what was happening in Motown? See, in a lot of other places, guys would just read charts and things like that. Motown, they would give these guys charts, but until the very later years, they were very minimal, just basic chord charts. And if you tried to write something for like a James Jamerson, he'd laugh at you, he'd take a look at the chart, "Yeah, you want me to play this bull?" And they'd say, "No, I want you to do your thing." Just take, it was real, you know, it was a standard thing. You'd just throw it in there.
Yeah, he did that a lot of times in studio. Yeah. Took the music and just off there and throw it on the floor.
One of the things we're doing, now is really, you know, the soundtrack is out in stores right now, and it's a 2-CD deal. The second CD will be out around January. And what we're doing is we went back into the vaults at Universal, where they have all the original multi-tracks.
That's it.
And there's two vault tracks in there. Keep Me Hanging On and Burn Death. Yeah. And we got 16 vault tracks that we pulled out, like the Diana Ross version of Inner Mountain, I Was Made to Love Her, My Guy, My Girl, a whole bunch of, and we're remixing them from the musician standpoint. So in other words, that means no vocals. And people, you know, me said, "Who's going to do the melody?" And my thing is to them is, there's different melodies. Listen to the melody on a piano. Listen to the melody of that bass. And we're basically pushing faders and mute buttons all over the place, soloing instruments. You can hear all these incredible parts that were buried for decades under the singers. So, you know, like some, we might have a thing where you got this full orchestration, all of a sudden we hit a bunch of mute buttons, and all of a sudden it's just Euro and Jamerson. And then we pull out Euro and it's just Jamerson. And then we pull out Jamerson and it's just Euro. And you get to hear all these incredible parts of you. And these are songs that we all know so well. And you go, "Oh my God, I never heard that stuff."
We would cut sometime in the day, right? Go home, get dressed, go to night gig. And then after we get off our gig, maybe one of the artists or studio, somebody would come in, arrange or writers would come in on our gig and tell us, "Can we come to the studio after we get through playing?"
Well, they have the Motown Museum. The studio where we cut. Have you seen the film, or are you going to see it tonight?
I've seen it. I have.
Okay, well, you know where the song we did in the Snake Pit with Michelle? I think we're the first people to cut since they left there. It's been a museum for 30 years.
And it's still workable?
No, well, we had to bring in a mobile recording truck.
We got a jazz museum there, too. Greystone Jazz Museum.
But the other half of the film that makes this so significant, you know, one half is the music, because when you have a monumental contribution of this size, it's very significant. You know, because these guys have had the impact of the Beatles, although they were faceless. But when you, this is also a story, you know, these are magnetic, riveting characters. And we were, you know, the movie also explores their life outside of just music, you know, the trials and tribulations that they had.
Right, it was hilarious.
Yeah, exactly. Dealing with each other. And it's a great story, and just the story of these guys is a social unit aside from the musical part. And the characters, like James Jamerson, was a tormented genius. So he was very cinematic. You know, I mean, it was very easy to do these stories around Jamerson because it's the ultimate, like, sex, drugs, and rock and roll story. And there is a basic bad guy here, which is not Berry Gordy, it's obscurity itself. And the fact that these guys have had to endure this for 40 years and have come out of it with so much dignity and grace in accepting their position, and then at the end of their lives, which hopefully will be another 40 years, they get to go out like winners. And justice is done, and the fact that they were up, you know, I think it's much sweeter that they're getting their place in the sun now than if they had gotten it earlier. So...
Yeah, there was something to listen to, the reminiscing, the information that you learn from the past. And you do learn from the past, and you learn things that you can put to good use in the future as well. The language got a little salty, so you heard I edited several times. But it was worth it. It was the Funk Brothers, the fabulous Funk Brothers, the backup band for all of the big Motown artists of the 60s and early 70s. Pleasure to talk to them. As they toured around the country following their documentary film, Standing in the Shadow of Motown. And it was something to meet them and get to hear their stories as well. The Jazz Insiders coming up next. Great jazz, information behind the jazz, followed by the blues from 3 to 6. KKFI is known for its jazz and its blues programming, and that continues through the Memorial Day here today. Jazz at 1 o'clock, the blues from 3 to 6, right here on your community radio station, 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. So until next we meet, ladies and gentlemen, at that crossing the road, I'm Michael Hoag. We'll see you next time.